I'm songwriter Charlie Harding.
And I'm musicologist Nate Sloan.
We're the hosts of Switched on Pop, a podcast about the making and meaning of popular music.
Every week, Charlie and I break down the most interesting hits, trends, and artists to understand what they're doing, what they're saying, and why these songs are so infectious.
We've recently broken down Billie Eilish's music with her brother and collaborator Phineas, dissected Chance the Rapper with super producer Oak Felder, and covered everything from Dolly Parton to Travis Scott.
If you love music, you're going to discover something ear-opening in Switched on Pop.
So join us. Search for Switched on Pop in your favorite podcast app and listen to an episode about your favorite artist.
And subscribe for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening to get new music explainers every week.
And after listening, you might want to check out our new book, Switched on Pop, How Popular Music Works and Why It Matters at your favorite bookseller. Thanks.
Ahoy, Mets fans. Back to Amazing Avenue Audio, the show. This is the second time I'm recording this because I'm a transparent loser who can't just cover up his mistakes. I have to admit when I've done something wrong. So I just did this a minute ago, but it wasn't recording. So here we are again, and I'm letting you in on my shame. Filling in for the ailing Chris McShane tonight is my friend and yours, co-host of A Pod of Their Own, Allison McCaig. Hello, Allison. I'm sorry for making you do this introduction again.
Hello, Brian. That's okay. You know what? We live and we learn. It's all good.
Yeah. So it's been an interesting few weeks to be a Mets fan. I mean, it's been an interesting lifetime to be a Mets fan. But this, you know, the start of the new year has especially been interesting. You know, we had a manager and then we didn't. We were going to have a new owner and now we don't. And so among the Carlos Beltran, Luis Rojas, Steve Cohen, Will Pons disaster, which of it damaged your soul the most, Allison?
I would have to say probably the Carlos Beltran stuff is more upsetting. I mean, it's all very bad. I mean, it makes me think of that tweet that everyone knows that's like, the main goal is to not be the main character of Twitter. Like, there's one main character of Twitter every day, and your goal is to not be it. And I feel like the Mets, I mean, I guess the Astros a little more, but I feel like this offseason, the Mets have been the main character of Twitter, and like, when are they not? And it's like, I'm just sick to death of it. So like, that encompasses everything. But I think that Carlos Beltran is worse because with the Steve Cohen stuff, it's more like, A, I'm not upset necessarily that like ultra billionaire ghoul Steve Cohen is not going to swoop in and save the Mets. I'm not sure how much of a difference it would have made. It's more like a symbolic thing of how bad the Wilpons are. And we kind of already knew that. It's just like ramping it up to level 11. Mm-hmm. But the Carlos Beltran stuff, Ken Lavin of Amazing Avenue of our prospect team, he put it best. He called it a drive-by Metsing. And I think that that is a perfect description of the Carlos Beltran situation and why it's more soul-crushing to me. Because like the Mets didn't actually really do anything wrong. They just kind of stumbled ass backwards into the sign-stealing scandal and lost their manager because of it. And like, I love Carlos with my whole heart and like desperately wanted the like Carlos Beltran redemption story arc, and now we're never gonna get it. So that being ripped from me was probably more soul crushing than, you know, some billionaire.
Yeah, I think it's you have to talk about, you know, what sort of heartbreak we're talking about here, because on one hand, I think that even if Carlos Beltran was the greatest manager in Mets history and manage the team for longer than anyone else in Mets history, he would still likely lose his job before the Mets have another set of owners if Cohen had bought the team. Like, if Cohen had bought the team, he would be the owner long after Beltran was no longer a Met anymore. And so, in terms of long-term effects, I think the Cohen thing stings. But like you said, I mean, Cohen seems like a pretty shady dude, as, you know, to be fair, most billionaires are. Sorry to any billionaire listeners. If any billionaire listens to this, I'm not talking about you. I'm probably talking about you.
Is Mike Bloomberg listening to this right now?
Exactly. You know, so I don't necessarily think that he would have been a moral victory over the Bullpons, but I think that he would have at least been the type of evil billionaire to spend money on this team, which if you're going to take an evil billionaire as your owner, that's the kind of evil billionaire you want, I suppose. You know, the Wilpons, I know a lot of people, including some friends of ours, have said that the Wilpons, for all their problems, they just want to win. Like, they'll do anything to win. And I can respect that to a certain degree, but I also think that they just are... The best thing that Wilpons could do to win would be to step out of the baseball business. Even if they were owners, they could be hands-off passive owners, but they'll never do that, you know? Right. And so they're too dumb to recognize the best thing they could do is to not be involved. And so, yes, I would have liked to have seen someone else in there, but I don't think that's necessarily necessarily heartbreaking that it's not going to be this billionaire.
Yeah.
What I will say about the Beltran situation is that, like Ken said, you know, a drive-by Metsing in where the Mets for once did not do anything wrong. I've seen some people very critical of the Mets not, I guess, grilling Beltran more during his interview, but I don't think you can really get mad at the Mets for that.
Yeah, I don't think so either. I think it's more like, given Brody Van Wagenen's relationship to AJ Hinch and Carlos Beltran's obviously strong relationship to the Astros, you have to wonder why, like, AJ Hinch or somebody from the Astros didn't, like, text Beltran, like, hey, you know, this story's going to come out. The reporters have been sniffing around and asking questions. Because, like, the story broke, like, 2 days after the Mets hired Beltran or something like that. So, like, if you want to give the Mets the most benefit of the doubt and say that they didn't know, like, why exactly did they not know? And, like, it's not so much like, well, they really should have grilled Carlos Beltran. It's more like, why didn't, like, Brody Van Wagenen ask his friend AJ Hinch about it? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely a part of it. That is odd. But I also think that even if you think that the Mets didn't do their due diligence during the interview process, which I guess is a take you can have, I think the Mets handled the dismissal or the whole scenario really, really well. You know, and I don't say that lightly as a Mets fan, but they didn't necessarily throw him under the bus, which I feel like the Wilpons had to be probably physically restrained from not doing, because that is what they live for, is throwing Carlos Beltran under the bus. But they didn't throw him under the bus. They didn't say it was unfair. They didn't really bitch and moan too much. They sort of took their lumps and moved on with a modicum of grace. And that's far more than I thought I would say about the way the Wilpons handle any situation. And so I think just in terms of like the soul crushingness of it, I think it's just the combination of both things happening at once.
Yes.
You know, it's just like, oh, we may have nice things in the future. Oh, we may have nice things this year. Nope. Neither's going to work out.
We never get nice things.
No.
It's like, and the whole, like, you were talking about how, like, yeah, there's the argument of some folks that the Wilpons at least care and seemingly care and want to win, which is better than a lot of other baseball owners. And I'll agree with that to a large extent, but it's like, they're the other end of the extreme. Like, can't you have a nice happy medium of an owner who cares but understands that they're not the smartest guy in the room here, and that they actually leave the baseball operations to the baseball operations people? Like we either get owners who, like, completely don't care and want to cost cut all the time and, like, McKinsey their baseball team, or you get the Wilpons who, like, don't necessarily believe in tanking probably, but also believe in micromanaging everything.
Yeah.
Which is what got them into this mess with Cohen, because the reason Cohen backed out of the deal is because the Wilpons wanted to retain control of the team and just use his money. It's like, what makes you think anyone would agree to that? Like,
so here is the point that I wanted, that came out today, that I would like to pick your brain about a little bit, which was that it said that the Mets will now hold a more, it was tweeted by John Heyman.
It's like an auction style.
He said a more typical auction. I can't imagine an auction giving the Wilpons control.
Right.
This seemed like, all right, we're not going to go to auction. We're going to give you maybe a better price than you would have gotten at auction, but we want to control the team for 5 years.
Yeah.
And so I can't see that being a condition of an auctioned sale.
I can't either. Otherwise, no one would be buying.
Right, exactly.
Bidding, rather, I guess.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to say was, from this Heyman tweet, he said, also, after what happened here, belief is that Steve Cohen, despite his reported $13 billion, will have trouble ever buying any team.
That makes no sense to me.
Yeah, unless something happened on the Cohen side, not to coincide, the Cohen space side of the deal that we're not aware of. It seems very odd to me.
And Andy Martino also tweeted Cohen made no friends in the league with this. And I'm just I don't know. To me, this is just these guys just openly shilling for the Wilpons. And it's just kind of gross to me. Can you not? Everyone knows that you're trying to pin this on Steve Cohen when we all know it's because the Wilpons are snakes. I don't know. That's just blatant media shilling to me. Maybe they may know something I don't, because obviously they're well sourced and I'm not. But I don't see how Cohen is the guy that loses credibility here.
Yeah,
owners protect other owners, and so Manfred's going to shill for the Wilpons because that's literally his job as commissioner. And other owners are going to protect other owners. And so, I don't know, Cohen tried to, invade their club and, made one of them mad. So now, in solidarity, the rest of them are going to be mad. But, I just don't see how that's the case. I don't know.
I agree with you. It seems very odd to me. But, who knows? Who knows what this insanity is going to bring? But let's talk about something a little bit more hopeful, which is the pending start of spring training. Pitchers and catchers will be reporting a week from today, I guess, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think it is a week from today.
Somewhere in this ballpark. And that is certainly good news. Just sort of in general, how do you feel about the Mets this offseason? Do you think that they've addressed enough of the issues that the team had, or do you feel like there's going to be a reckoning over what wasn't done?
I feel like they did the usual Mets thing, which is that they went two-thirds of the way there, 75% of the way there, and not all the way there. And they let Zach Wheeler, they signed two starting pitchers, but they let Zach Wheeler walk, and neither starting pitcher that they signed is as good as him.
Right.
So the starting rotation might be slightly deeper than last year, but it's not better. And they didn't address all the things that I would have liked to have seen them address. Backup catcher being a glaring one, and the bullpen, they did some stuff, but I don't think they went far enough with it. I would have liked to have seen at least one more reliever and a way better backup catcher, bare minimum.
Somewhere Renee Rivera is crying.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Renee.
That's okay. I think that's about right. I think that there is a very real chance that the Mets have the best bullpen in the National League East.
Sure.
And possibly the National League, period, if things tend to go their way. And I think that will go a long way towards fixing some of the problems from last season. I also think that Pete Alonso probably won't hit 53 home runs next season. And so, there's going to be some regression to the mean from both the positives and the negatives of the 2019 season. But I think that the Mets have a fair shot at being competitive in the division. I don't know if they're going to run away with it. I don't know if there is going to be a wild card chase in the future. But, you know, I think that in general, the team looks okay. There is not any hole as glaring as the bullpen was last year.
Yes, that's probably true.
So I feel okay about that. But we've been doing something on Amazing Avenue called One Last Move, where we've been asking folks to talk about what they would do for one sort of smallish move to help the Mets contend more in 2020. Mine is not up yet, but I am writing about the Mets going after Taijuan Walker, who I think they could get for a song. And if he works out, great. And if not, it's going to cost them so little. Who cares?
Yep.
You wrote about Russell Martin.
Yes,
as
I did.
A backup catching option, which is consistent with what you said before.
Yes.
Our friend Michael wrote about Colin McHugh. Linda wrote about Wilmer Flores. And then he was signed to a multi-year deal by the Giants.
Good for Wilmer.
Yes, good for Wilmer. We will always be there for him because he was there for us.
Exactly.
Or something like that. Lucas wrote about Scooter Jeanette. By the time you guys hear this, Rich's profile of Derek Dietrich might be up. Danny Salazar was written about by Jack. Rob will be writing about Yasiel Puig soon. And Tommy Hunter was written about by Chris. So that's a pretty interesting collection of folks. Obviously, you wrote about Martin, so you can defend that choice stronger. But overall, do any of these names jump out at you as an intriguing player you would like to see the Mets go after?
I mean, I would say McHugh is probably the best pitcher still available. So I would love to see that. I don't expect it, but I would love to see it. I think that that would be an excellent choice. Obviously former Met, and a guy that can provide like a depth in the bullpen and the rotation, can be sort of a swingman if you need him to be, even though he's probably much more well suited to a bullpen role. But we have the two other guys who are competing for that fifth rotation spot, but you can never have enough starting pitching depth, and the Mets have very little in the way of reinforcements at AAA in that position. So I think that other than Russell Martin, I'm biased there. I think Colin McHugh is probably the name that sticks out to me among that crop of people.
Yeah, I mean, McHugh was who I wanted to write about, and then Michael came in and snagged it. And so
stole it from you.
Yeah, but that's all right. I'm always glad somebody wrote about him. We forgot to mention, too, our friend Vass wrote about Brock Holt. I forgot to mention Brock
Holt. Yes. You could probably get for an NRI. Like, that's the thing. Is like, there's some of these guys, like McHugh and probably Russell Martin and others, like, you'd have to sign them to a major league contract. But Brock Holt, you might be able to get him on a minor league deal. These are like easy things they could do.
I mean, and I know he's had a rough couple of years, but did you see that Felix Hernandez signed a minor league deal with the Braves?
Did he really? Yes. I didn't see that.
Yeah. You know, so these things happen. This isn't just armchair WFAN listener guy. Like, these deals do happen. I think, you know, Taijuan Walker might take a major league deal, but he might work for a minor league one. You can't hurt. They can't hurt. And my whole thing is that last year, right about this time, the Mets went out and they signed Rajay Davis and Carlos Gomez.
Luis Avilan.
There were a bunch of
signings. Pitched many innings.
Yes. But a bunch of them were outfielders because the Mets outfield was totally an unknown factor last season. And so they went out and they picked up all these veteran outfielders and stashed them all in AAA. And while none of them wound up being the solution, all of them were relatively useful to the team at one point or another. And then because they were signed to minor league deals, they were relatively easily dispatched when no longer useful for the team.
Right.
And I feel like the Mets need to do that more with pitching.
Yes. Absolutely. Which they did bring in Erasmo Ramirez, so there's that.
They did.
Yeah. Who else did they NRI? I think that might be the only pitcher they NRI'd. Well, they picked up at the beginning of the offseason, they picked up Steven Gonsalves off waivers. So he also exists now. But like, that's more of like AAA depth rather than a guy you'd want pitching a lot of innings at this point. But it's something.
Sure.
They NRI'd Eduardo Nunez. He's not a pitcher, but I think that there is a strong chance Eduardo Nunez makes the opening day roster.
Yeah, I think you can almost pencil that in right now, actually.
Yep.
Just because there's a couple of reasons for that. But yeah. But yeah, you know, I think that any of these moves would be quality ones for the Mets. And at this point, especially, I mean, the Dodgers were always one of the top couple of teams in the National League the last few years. But yeah, after getting Mookie Betts, I guess it's not official yet. Assuming that it works out with Mookie Betts, the Dodgers are clearly now a cut above in the National League. And
yeah,
so you need you need to do all you can to get into the playoffs, because one, you know, I don't see an easy path for anybody through the Dodgers, but you never know in playoff baseball. You just never know. And you know, Betts to the Mets, I love that rhyme, was never really discussed, but people sort of dreamed on it. And there were a number of deals this offseason that the Mets were linked to that never really happened. And so because the only real money you spent this year was on Betances, and because you are saving money on Carlos Beltran's contract, probably, right? Or did they still have to pay him?
No, they're not paying him, and that saves them like $2 million, $3 million.
Yeah. And, you know, I know they have to pay Rojas now, but Rojas is not going to be making
that
much money. And you're saving so much money on the Cespedes renegotiation of his contract. If you're not going to go sign one big player, sign 15 small ones right now. Give your team some real depth. It drives me crazy how little depth the Mets seem to care about at any and all times.
Yeah, it's kind of mind-boggling because these are like no-brainer moves that they just don't do. And it's like, come on, man. Like, it's not that hard.
And I think for a lot of these guys, coming off an injury or coming off a down year, you'll take a chance on a team that has Jacob deGrom, Pete Alonso, Jeff McNeil, Michael Conforto, Noah Syndergaard, you know, Edwin Diaz and Betances. Like, if you look at that team,
sure,
there is a strong core of a team there.
Yeah, definitely. You
know, roll the dice with them.
Yeah, why not?
I mean, they're the Mets, but...
They're the Mets, yeah. Counterpoint, they're the Mets, is always a solid counterpoint. But, yeah, no, the Mets always seem to fail on depth. And then they, like... And being as injury-prone as they are, then they act shocked that they, like, have to emergency trade for whatever other team's version of this is. And you're like, you could have just done this in the offseason. Like, oh my God, why am I blanking? What pitcher did they trade for from, like, the Rays, who ended up pitching, like, way more than he should have, and then they got rid of him and he went to the Blue Jays and was actually okay last season?
Oh, yeah.
It's going to bother me, so yeah. I'm going to look it up because, of course, I am. But anyway, we can keep talking while I do that. But, like,
I definitely
like,
know.
Like, they freaking do that stuff all the time.
Right, yeah.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Saving money on your car insurance is easy with Progressive. It's an average savings of $796 for customers who switch and save. In fact, customers can qualify for an average of 6 discounts on their auto policy with Progressive, including discounts just for starting a quote online or owning multiple vehicles. Get your quote online at progressive.com and see how much you could be saving. National average annual car insurance savings by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive in 2019. Discounts vary and are not available in all states and situations.
So before we go our separate ways tonight, let's just talk quickly about the rest of the National League East. Last year...
Wilmer Font.
Yes. Thank you. Which one of the teams in the National League East do you think improved the most this offseason? The answer could be the Mets.
In theory, it could be the Mets. That's true. because the Braves didn't. I still think it's the Braves, but by a slim margin. But I think it's the Braves, even though I know that they lost out on like the Donaldson sweepstakes, but they did sign Marcell Ozuna instead. So like, yes, they don't really have a true first baseman. They have a true first baseman. His name is Freddie Freeman, third baseman. They still were able to get that one more big bat that may not be quite as good as Donaldson, but they got a guy. Sure. And they improved their pitching situation pretty like they got some pretty good pitching. So I think the Braves improved the most. I think the Mets might be second, but the Nationals aren't that far away from the Mets either. The only reason why I feel like the Nats don't like take this is because they lost Rendon, and it's so hard to make up for that, even though they signed a bunch of guys to fill their bullpen out. Because the bullpen was obviously the big weakness for them during the season, and then they like basically avoided using it entirely in the playoffs by like brutalizing their starting pitchers. And they had like just enough bullpen to get through and win the World Series. So I think that they're trying to mitigate that, which good for them. They signed Will Harris. They brought back, what's his name? The guy that pitched in the playoffs a lot last season that I'm blanking on. Very bad. Bad of me. Not that guy is bad. But yeah, so the Nats improved their bullpen a lot, but obviously like that's not enough to balance the loss of Anthony Rendon, who they did not really replace. So I still think it's the Braves. Probably I would rank it like Braves, Mets, Nats, but like that's close. And the Phillies didn't really do much. So.
And the Marlins, of course.
And the Marlins are the Marlins.
Yeah.
Who did the Phillies even sign this offseason?
That's a good question. Let's see.
I'm like looking it up because I don't even remember who they signed.
I feel like there was a big one.
Oh, Anthony Dvorak.
Logan Forsythe?
They did that like literally yesterday.
Yeah. Let's see. See, they have invited so many non-roster invitees to spring training. If you're scrolling through their transactions, Neil Walker got a Francisco Liriano, Odubel Herrera. Man, this is a
other than Zach Wheeler. So okay, Zach Wheeler's the obvious thing that the Phillies did.
Yeah,
we knew that. Oh, and Didi Gregorius. That's the big one. That's the one. Yep. They got Gregorius. So that's pretty big. But like, I don't think the Phillies are that improved.
I think I'd put it Braves, Phillies, Mets, Nats, because I don't think anything that the Nats did will make up for Rendon.
Yeah, I forgot about Didi Gregorius. That does make the Phillies better for sure. And obviously, I knew that Wheeler made them better, but like, their starting pitching situation is still not super great. Even with Wheeler in the rotation, because they basically have Nola and Wheeler, and I mean, like is Arrieta like healthy anymore? Is he coming back?
I think he's supposed to be coming back,
but like, who knows with him if he'll be healthy? And then they have, and obviously they have like the Nick Pivetta, Zach Eflin situation, which is like meh, but I don't think that rotation can stand up to what the other teams in the NL East have. Now obviously the Phillies have strengths elsewhere, being their lineup mostly, which is quite good, especially now with Didi Gregorius in it. You know, Bryce Harper is obviously there, it's pretty good.
And I guess to me the question is more about, are the Phillies better now than they were at the end of the season? And I would say, yes, they are.
That's true.
They're not necessarily, even if they didn't do enough. Like, I still think that even though they did more than the Mets, let me put it this way. I think the Phillies are better. the Phillies improved more from the end of the season to the start of the season. But I think the Mets are still better than the Phillies.
Yeah, and the Mets had a higher baseline to work with than the Phillies did. Not by a lot, but they did. I think it was, like, which projection system came out? Was it a Baseball Reference? A projection system came out the other day that had a four-way tie for the National League wild card, and the Mets and the Phillies were two of the four, I think, teams. Tie for the second wild card.
Oh, okay.
So, like, there was, I think the Nats were the first wild card, and then it was a four-way tie for the second wild card, and two of those teams were the other two teams in the National League East. So they had four of the five teams in playoff position on the last day of the season, which is pretty crazy.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, I'll have to find. I saw it on Twitter, but I can't remember which projection it was. I think it might have been Baseball Reference.
So while you look that up, I'm just going to say, for listeners of the podcast, we'll probably have one more show in February, but then Chris and I will be down in Port St. Lucie together for a couple days at the end of the month, and I think the goal is to maybe try and do like a daily podcast while we're down there.
Just, oh, that would be so fun.
Just short stuff. We're seeing four games, and it's going to be a lot of fun, so look out for that stuff. Did you find out who it was?
USA Today.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was you, and I don't think it was like an actual like projection. It was here. So USA Today had like a 6-person panel, and they made like aggregate projections from what the 6 people predicted.
Okay.
And so in their thing, there are four teams with 85 wins in the National League, and so they all tie for the second wild card. So they have a tie for the first wild card also, because they have they don't have a tie, because that wouldn't make sense. It's they have Atlanta winning 92 games, so they have Atlanta winning the division, and then they have the Nationals with the first wild card at 88 wins, and they also have the Cardinals at 88 wins, but they win the NL Central. And then they have the Mets, Phillies, Reds, and Diamondbacks all at 85 and 77.
Wow.
For a four-way tie for the second wild card, which is totally wild. And, like, it's kind of like how it was last season. Like, the American League is, like, super feast or famine. You obviously have, like, the, like, big teams winning. Like, they have the Yankees winning, like, 103 games and the Orioles winning 57 games.
Right, yeah.
Whereas the National League, everybody except basically like Miami and Pittsburgh are like clustered together in like the same, like nobody, the highest win total they have is the Dodgers at 99 wins. But then like Atlanta only has 92 wins and they're the second best team.
Yeah, that's.
And there is, let me count the teams between. So there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 teams between 82 wins and 88 wins.
Wow.
Wow. This will be fun if it happens.
Yeah, I do think the National League is a relatively, I think there is relative parity in the National League right now.
Which I like.
Yeah, me too. I will say, though, that as much as I like parity in theory, it's also it was nice those couple of years where the Mets were one of two or three good teams in the division.
Yeah.
And you got 18 games to beat up on two different teams.
Yeah, it's true. And like the parity does make it all the more frustrating when we're talking about these moves on the margins, like signing NRIs and making these one last moves that all of us wrote about. Like when you're projected to be in a four-way tie for the second wild card, literally Derek Dietrich's half a win or whatever might have been the difference.
Yep.
Between the playoffs and not. Like, that's how much these little moves on the margins can matter.
Somebody had said to me, I forget who it was. I was at I think it was like a holiday party or something, and somebody said to me, mark my words, Jed Lowry is going to put the Mets over the top. I thought, like, all right, we'll see about that.
Sure.
But it's actually pretty funny that a move from last offseason might impact the team this season while having zero impact on the team last season.
I'm going to give my hot take bold prediction live on the pod.
Let's go for it.
Which is that I think Yoenis Cespedes is going to have a higher WAR in 2020 than Jed Lowry.
Oh, that's a fun bet. Because both are pretty crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's, I think Yoenis Cespedes is going to be over one WAR and Jed Lowry is going to be under one WAR.
Oh, that's okay. Here's a question for you.
Mm.
Well, it's a series of three questions for you.
Okay.
Are both Lowry and Cespedes on the opening day roster?
I think actually neither of them are.
Are either Lowry or Cespedes on the team at the All-Star break? Either they've been activated because they're healthy or they've been traded away. Like, are they Mets still?
I think both of them are Mets. I think Cespedes is active and playing and Lowry's not.
Okay. Are either active Mets on September 1st?
Both.
Interesting. Okay. See, I wouldn't be surprised if one of those two gets traded to an American League team at some point.
Yeah, possible. True. Like, if Cespedes, like... Well, I said one WAR for the entire season.
Okay.
So, like,
okay.
That's not a lot of playing time. So, like, because if Cespedes is, like... I still don't think he's going to be on the opening day roster. I think that that's a little too optimistic to think. But if he's, like... borderline putting up one WAR before the All-Star break, like, he might get traded. Yeah. Depending on where the Mets are at, I guess.
Well, I just think at a certain point, it becomes a numbers game with the number of players they want to get playing time for.
Yeah.
And, you know, love Cespedes to death, but he's not a center fielder anymore.
And he's not. He's probably not even a left fielder anymore.
Right, yeah. And you know, their corners are so crowded to begin with.
Yeah, yeah.
And crowded by guys who are bad defenders.
Yes.
So you don't want to add another bad defender into that. And
so it's like, yeah, like, I realize Yoenis Cespedes is already, like, he already had lower body issues before the calcified heels. And, I mean, obviously it was, like, all contributing. But, like, his fielding skills, other than his throwing arm, which still seemed fine, but his, like, ability to run and stuff and get to balls was declining. But, like, is even limping Cespedes would be a better left fielder than JD Davis, I think.
Or Dom Smith.
Or Dom Smith, who is, like, actually a disaster. I mean, they keep saying that DH is going to come to the National League anyway, so if Cespedes, like, proves that he's alive, just re-sign him and make him the DH.
Well, I think they're really planning to have... Cano be that DH.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. They planned for that, I think. Mets have a lot of DH types on their team, in their National League team. Roster building.
Yes, they do.
Like, Dom Smith, JD Davis, Yoenis Cespedes, and Robinson Cano. Oh, Robinson Cano isn't there yet. He's still a decent defender now, but, like, he's going to get there pretty soon.
Yes. All right, Allison, it's time for our music pick of the week. What is your music pick this week?
So my music pick is actually connected to TV. So for those of you who don't know, and if you follow me on Twitter, you probably do, because I talk about it. I don't talk about it as much as I talk about baseball, but, like, it's probably the TV show I talk about most. My favorite TV show in the entire world is BoJack Horseman, and it just finished... Like, the series ended. They had their, it's Netflix, so they release everything all at once. It's not, like, every week, like, network TV. So the final season of BoJack was in two parts. The first half season of 8 episodes came out, like, in October or something like that. And then they just released the second batch of 8 episodes, the second half of the final season of BoJack Horseman on January 30th. And so I got around to watching it over the past 2 days, and my soul is destroyed because I'm sad because this thing I love is over forever. However, there was in the finale, in the very last scene, which I will not spoil what is happening in the scene, but a song plays, and it's called Mr. Blue by Catherine Feeney. And I didn't know the song, and I really liked it. I was like, this song that's playing is really nice and like perfectly fits with the scene, and I really like the song. So I went and like looked up the song, played the song, and then played a bunch of other like random songs from Catherine Feeney and really enjoyed all of them. So my music recommendation is Catherine Feeney. She's great. She has a, I think her first album is a self-titled album, so I think it's just called Catherine Feeney. I might be wrong though, but
what sort of music is it?
It's like very, what does it remind me of? I had like a, I had a comparison in mind, like very like Sarah Bareilles-y, okay, but like better in my opinion. So like she's a singer songwriter, kind of folksy, you know, that's how I would call it. Yeah. It lists her genre as folk. So okay. The internet. So.
And what was the name of the song that you heard?
Mr. Blue, it's called. I'm
sure that like everybody right now is searching this on Spotify.
Yeah.
Okay, it's from an album called Hurricane Glass.
Yes. Okay. Her first album was self-titled, like I thought. It's called Catherine Feeney. But yeah, the album that Mr. Blue is on is called Hurricane Glass.
All right. I'll have to check that out tomorrow. I'm not familiar at all. I've also never seen an episode of BoJack Horseman. I'm ducking right now because you're throwing things at me through the magic of Skype. But
I highly recommend it to anyone and everyone.
It's a show I firmly plan to watch.
Yes. But,
you know, hours in the day, children, etc.
Yeah, I understand. But it's, you know, they're short episodes, so it's a relatively easy binge because they're 30-minute episodes instead of an hour. And, you know, it's a show that, like, you know, it's a cartoon and, like, it's about a talking horse. So you, like, don't see the emotional blows coming when they come. And I think that makes them all the more potent when they do come, because it's, like, and it's hilarious, too. It is definitely a dark comedy in every sense. Like, there are parts of it that are, like, deep belly laughs, can't breathe hilarious. But there are some heavy, heavy topics that are dealt with in that show that it just does with such depth and poise, and I could not say enough good things about BoJack Horseman. It's literally my favorite show I have ever watched on television, period.
Wow.
Of all time. Yep.
Wow. All right. Well, I'll have to check that out tomorrow for sure. So I have not been an active music writer for a long time. I used to write for a couple different websites doing record reviews, but just life got in the way. And so every now and then I'll publish one, but I still think of myself as a music writer. And there's an exercise going on Twitter this month called, it's hashtag MWE Music Writers Exercise, where you're supposed to listen to an album that you have not heard in its entirety and then write a short review of it on Twitter.
That's very fun.
Yeah, it is. And so what I did was I pulled out a couple of albums that I had read about from 2019 that I had a chance to listen to before the end of the year. So I put like five songs from that. I put five albums that I have that have come out this year that I was interested in. And then the rest I pulled from I have a book that I was given a number of years ago called 1001 Albums You Should Hear Before You Die.
And that's a very good book for you.
Yes, although I typically hate those list books. I disagree with them all the time. But I thought, like, well, there's so much stuff in this book that I just haven't read, but I haven't heard before. And so I just like flipped through the book, and kind of at random, and picked out 19 albums to put into this list. And every morning I use a random number generator to pick the album I'm going to listen to.
That's a good method. I like that.
You know, and so I've listened to seven albums so far this year, some by artists I already knew, some by artists I didn't, but the one I want to talk about is, it's an album from the mid-60s, it's by a band called The Centurions, and the album is called Surfer's Pajama Party, and it's
awesome.
It's a surf rock band. This is an album, actually, the reason this made the list was because one of their songs is used on the Pulp Fiction soundtrack, and I happen to be... channel surfing the other night, Pulp Fiction was on, and I watched about 10 minutes of it, and I recognized it. I'm like, I don't know this song. Who is this? I looked it up, and so I put it on the list. And I love surf rock. Like, I joke with the one of the guys I play in a band with that, like, I was born 40 years too late. Like, if I had been born in the 40s, I'd have been, like, 18, 19 around the surf rock time, and I'd have been a bass player in a surf rock band. I love surf rock. So this album is... It's all instrumental. It's a lot darker than I think. I would imagine a lot of surf rock people would like people when you hear surf rock, I think you think like Walk Don't Run, Hawaii 5-0, that kind of stuff. And this stuff it's a little bit sort of darker sounded than that. I really, really enjoy it. And there's a great saxophone player in the band, and the bass, and I'm a bass player, so the bass really sounds like a modern band's bass tone. I'm sort of shocked at how modern the bass sound is. So I really enjoy it. The album is on Spotify, so you can find it there. It's called Surfer's Pajama Party by the Centurions. So Allison, thank you for coming on the show this week. I really appreciate it.
Of course, Brian. Anytime.
Where can folks find you on the interwebs?
I am on Twitter at PetitePhD, and you can find our podcast, the sister show to this show, on Twitter at A Pod of Their Own.
And if you haven't heard A Pod of Their Own, you're missing out. It is an essential listen in my podcast rotation. I'm on Twitter at Brian Needs a Nap. You can find so much more from Allison, from myself, from Chris, from the whole Amazing Avenue gang at AmazingAvenue.com. You can follow Amazing Avenue on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Amazing Avenue. This podcast is part of the Amazing Avenue Podcast Network, which is found on Stitcher, on Spotify, on Apple Podcasts. Anywhere you get podcasts, hopefully you can find this one. And so we'll probably be back before spring training gets too deep underway. And until then, let's go Mets.